On the 19th of November 1981, human rights lawyer Griffiths Mngenge stopped his car on the side of the road in Umlazi, KwaZulu-Natal. He wanted to help a group of men who he believed had broken down.
They pretended they had an accident, they needed help. One early evening time. And Griffith, being a man of a good heart, would not drive past them. He thought he could give help. That was a trap.
Former ANC leader Matthew Sporza knows what happened to Griffiths Mngenge because he witnessed the apartheid death squad members who had killed him describe his murder. Mngenge's killers were a mix of askaris, ANC operatives who had been turned against the party by apartheid authorities, and police officers selected by Vlakplaas death squad commander Dirk Coetzee to carry out the murder.
And I said they should specifically not use guns and must make it look like a robbery, and it was decided on knives, that Mr. Mngenge will be killed with knives.
Coetzee revealed that apartheid police wanted to create the impression that Griffiths Mngenge had been killed by the ANC, a party he had gone to jail to support and regularly defended in court. As you will discover, the full truth about Griffiths Mngenge's murder only ever emerged because of a death row confession by one of his killers, just hours before he was due to be hanged.
Can you give any reason why he was stabbed so many times?
The reason I suspect is that all the time he was not falling to the ground, he was fighting.
He fought to save his own life, didn't he?
That is correct, sir.
Coetzee and his fellow death squad members, Vlakplaas Security Police base operatives David Sikilanga and the man whose voice you've just heard, Armand Nofomela, all received amnesty from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission for the brutal murder of Griffiths Mngenge. He'd been killed because the apartheid police couldn't find a way to prosecute the ex-Robben Island prisoner who had used their laws against them.
That he was a thorn in the flesh to them, but he was sticking to the rules of the law, and by doing that, they couldn't get a charge built up against him, a case built up against him to charge him in court criminally with the law available to them.
One of the things that I think he was very proud of is that he was using the law developed by the system to beat the system.
Notorious apartheid askari Joe Mamasela, who murdered several dozen anti-apartheid activists, was also part of the group of men who stabbed Griffiths Mngenge to death. But he never applied for amnesty from the TRC. No one ever went to jail for the murder of Griffiths Mngenge or for the murder of his wife, Victoria, who was savagely killed just 4 years after her husband was butchered, in front of the man whose voice you just heard, her son, Mabasa. He was just 19 years old when his mother, who had been shot and hacked by apartheid security police, died in his arms.
I think South Africa lost. And I think the system understood that getting rid of him and Mama would demoralize, as it were, the ANC, the community that we came from. And I think the intention was to try and send a very strong message to his comrades to say, you know, if you continue to fight, we will not arrest you anymore. We have no time for that.
This is not an easy story to listen to, but it needs to be told. This is part one of the unresolved story of Griffiths and Victoria Mngenge.
Spirit of truth, set us free.
The first thing you need to know about Griffiths and Victoria Mnenge is that they loved each other.
They were teens when they met. I think it was... Mama was visiting one of her uncles, etc.
It was the other way around.
Oh.
Dad was in Tamaha.
Yes.
To visit an aunt.
Okay.
And so, Mama was beautiful.
No, she was very pretty.
I think my father was a hopeless romantic. Because they would get up, so we're sitting there, we're having dinner, there's all these other kids. And he would get up and he'd be like, these kids can't dance. So I just show them how to dance. So they would then get up and start, you know, sucking type of dance, which we thought, okay, this is not what. So I think they were very, for their time, romantic. And I don't know where I know the story from, Budi, but I remember someone saying that Mom used to love chocolates. And he would always bring her Smarties, because that's what she loved. And then I remember this other time, actually, my mom had cold feet, and he bought her an electric blanket, and it was a big thing at home that, you know, he's surprising her with this electric blanket.
It was at that stage, I mean, electric blankets were unheard of.
Yes.
United by their love of each other and their children, Griffiths and Victoria Mnenge also shared a deep commitment to fighting the evils of apartheid. That fight would cost Griffiths Mnenge his freedom. In 1961, he was imprisoned for 2 years on Robben Island under the Suppression of Communism Act for furthering the aims of the ANC. His first son, Mabasa, was born while he was in detention. Mabasa would later discover that his father had been incorrectly told that his wife had suffered a miscarriage while he was imprisoned. So he was genuinely shaken when she visited him on Robben Island with a baby in her arms.
He couldn't understand why Mama had this child in her arms, because he lost his child and therefore this can't possibly be his child, and he had grief for his child. But obviously he couldn't confront her to say, I know that you lost the baby, and you know, what happened? And whose child is this? And later on in life, I think I was about 8 or so, as he was playing with me, he looked at my hands and realized that my hands resemble his to a fault. And now he started calling everyone in the house. You know. So for something like 8 years, he had lived with this story that he had lost this child. And now he confirmed for himself that actually this is my child. And I thought all along that I had lost this child.
Despite being repeatedly imprisoned and banned by the apartheid government, Mnenge used his legal qualifications to not only defend anti-apartheid activists, but to fight for the rights of South Africa's marginalized and brutalized black population.
He was a larger-than-life person. And so he hated everything that in his mind was bad. And, you know, he worked with trade unions, he worked with the Black Conscious Movement, he worked, you know, everyone that he could hold hands with to defeat what he perceived as bad, you know, was his comrade.
So when I think of my father, I can see, like my brother is saying, he was smart and he knew how to outbid the system that is created to put him down.
During his legal career, Griffiths Mnenge defended ANC and Umkhonto Sizwe member Joseph Mdluli, who died on the 19th of March 1976 from injuries sustained during his torture by security branch members in Fisher Street, Durban. Mwenge demanded answers about Mdluli's death, and his efforts and international pressure led to four policemen being charged with culpable homicide. But Griffiths Mwenge paid a price for his campaign on behalf of Mdluli. He was detained. The apartheid state would only ever unleash its full hatred of him years later.
I think apartheid sought to destroy those that saw the evil in it. And everyone had this conspiracy around them to make sure that if you raise your head and say this is bad, then you, with the most gruesome way, your voice should be shut down. You should not be able to raise these issues.
In the last months of his life, Griffiths Mwenge knew that the apartheid state was intent on silencing him.
Earlier in the year, that is now 1981, he had bought a piece of land outside King Williamstown because he was saying, you know what, we need to move. And I want to go back home, etc. Remember, we're living in Mlazi then. And I suppose he knew then that, you know, they were coming for him. Yeah, that this was inevitable. But instead of fleeing the country, he decided that he'll fight on. You know, if they come for him, then they come for him.
The 46-year-old father of three had evidence that the apartheid state wanted him dead. Earlier in 1981, the year that he was killed, he survived a mysterious attempted murder.
The car that he was using was tampered with. I think one of the front wheels was loosened. And I suppose what they were trying to do is to see a car accident, and then it could be blamed on that.
Then, in November 1981, the plotting of the apartheid security police reached a terrible and cold-blooded climax.
I think it's a matter of public knowledge that Mr. Griffiths Mwenge was killed on the 19th of November, 1981. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Now, were you involved in his murder?
I was involved in the murder, yes, Mr. Chairman. For instance, in Mr. Mwenge's case, I was asked to make a plan with him, which clearly meant to me that we must kill him.
The recording that you have just heard was made during the 1996 amnesty applications of Vlakplaas commander Dirk Coetzee, policeman Armand Nofomela, and Vlakplaas base operative David Sekelanga. Over several days, Coetzee, Nofomela, and Sekelanga, who had been convicted of murdering Griffiths Mwenge just months before, recounted the killing and its motive in gruesome and heartbreaking detail. Coetzee maintained that he was just following the orders of senior commander Brigadier Johannes van der Hoeven when he orchestrated Griffiths Mwenge's murder in November 1981.
A few days before the 19th of November, on a morning briefing, he asked me to make a plan with Mr. Mwenge. He then, in very short terms, briefed me that he was an ex-Robben Island convict, that he was an attorney, that they were trying to build up a case against him because he was an acting, instructing attorney in all ANC cases who were caught in the country, and that an amount, something to 100,000 rand, went through his bank account. He said we must not use guns or make him disappear. We must make it look like a robbery.
Coetzee told the TRC that Griffiths Mwenge had been under surveillance by the security police and his phone had been tapped. The officer in charge of that surveillance was Captain Andy Taylor, who gave Coetzee a description of Griffiths Mwenge's office and his house and how many dogs he had. Taylor also gave him a photo of Griffiths Mwenge and arranged for him to be shown his office, his home, and his car.
The information was also given to us that he usually works late at night and his wife usually leaves before him.
Kutsia requested that notorious Askari Joe Mamasela be part of the team that would murder Griffiths Mnenge. Mamasela arrived in Durban on the 17th of November 1981, the same day that the security police poisoned the Mnenge family's four dogs at their home in Mlazi with meat laced with strychnine.
I remember what they had done was that, I think it was a Friday before he was killed. They poisoned the dogs at home, and I think they probably knew then that this is coming. But I think they were not the type that would then choose to run, because I thinking about it now, poisoning the dogs was meant to be plan B or plan C, you know, so that if they can't find him in the street, then they will have to go into the house. So obviously they knew then that something had happened.
I remember the day that Dada died, and I remember it being raining. I remember Mama being anxious that Dada is not home. And if you think about it now, for starters, you know, in relationships, people panic about things that don't really matter. But I almost feel as if she knew something was wrong. And I remember, so if Dada wasn't around, I would sleep with her. And I remember her not sleeping. And probably literally, in the sense that having read that she actually went around everywhere. Looking for him. Just the idea that she wasn't thinking he's gone out to his friends after work. She just knew that something was wrong. And I suppose that's why they made such a good partnership, is this.
Right.
They were kindred spirits.
Kutsia would later recount how his commanding officer told him on the morning after Griffiths Mnenge was murdered that Victoria Mnenge had called the security police to seek answers about her missing husband's whereabouts.
He did at the morning meeting tell me on the 20th that Mr. Mnenge's wife has phoned already to inquire whether the security police hasn't possibly arrested him the previous night because he did not come home.
But Griffiths Mnenge never did come home. His brutally wounded and battered body was found by passers-by on the morning of the 20th of November 1981. Victoria Mnenge was left to look after her children and fight an apartheid system intent on lying about her husband's death on her own.
It was also reported in that way in the next morning's Afrikaans newspaper. I think it was Beeld. General Johan Kutsia made a statement to the effect that it was the ANC, and this was because of some quarrel between Mr. Mnenge and the ANC. I can't exactly remember, but I'm sure we'll get that newspaper and one will see that, as always, the actions were blamed onto the ANC.
There are two occasions where I ever saw her in grief. The first time was when we went to the place where he was killed, and that broke her, because you know the blood was still there, etc., and you know it was clear that this is where he had finally died. And the second time was when there was an inquest. You know, I think that also the insensitivity of the system through the magistrate, etc. You know, I think that that was the second time when she showed, the grief. But she tried very hard to protect us from seeing that.
Despite all her grief, Victoria Mnenge fought tirelessly to challenge the apartheid government's claims that her husband had been murdered by the ANC because he had mishandled the Liberation Organization's money.
You are grieving the loss of your husband, and the system is saying, no, he died in the hands of the ANC because he had, mismanaged the monies from the ANC, because that is the narrative that they immediately tried to push, you know, as a way of, keeping everyone away from what had actually happened.
On one hand, you're grieving the loss of your husband, right? On the other hand, you're fighting the system because they're dragging your husband's name into the mud. And for that, actually, personally, I'll forever be grateful that she wasn't willing to sit down in a corner and play dead, because she understood what the consequences could possibly be.
In the end, though, the magistrate presiding over the inquest into the murder of Griffiths Mnenge found that his death was caused by the act of some unknown person or persons. It would take years before the truth about what had really happened to him would be revealed in the confession of a death row prisoner who was just hours away from his own hanging. That prisoner was Armand Nofomela.
At present, you are serving a life sentence. Is that correct?
It is so, sir.
For what crime is that?
I killed a white man from a farm in Brits.
The white man in question was a farmer called Johannes Lorenz, who Nofomela and an accomplice had stabbed to death in 1986. Nofomela was sentenced to die by hanging, but he clung to the belief that his former security police colleagues would intervene to ensure that he was not executed.
But they kept him till the last day before his execution, and when his poor mother was running up and down between the jail and Brigadier Schoen's office, who refused to see him, a message was sent to him: you must take your pains.
On the 19th of October 1989, just hours before he was due to die, Nofomela wrote a detailed affidavit explaining the role he had played in the apartheid death squad who had killed Griffiths Mnenge. That affidavit convinced a High Court judge to grant an order staying his execution, and calls for an investigation into his claims grew after Dirk Coetzee backed them up. The apartheid government reacted by appointing the Harams Commission to investigate whether Coetzee and Nofomela had been part of an officially authorized and funded death squad. The commission found no evidence to back up the men's allegations of army and police involvement in hit squad activities. It was a whitewash. Coetzee and his men were later charged and convicted of the murder of Griffiths Mnenge. Months later, they gave their horrific account of his death to the TRC.
To be honest with you, I think the first time I actually grieved for my father was during TRC time. Before then, and this is something I suppose we need to work on as a nation. The only thing I remember being hearing was, you need to be strong, you need to be strong. And I wasn't sure what I needed to be strong for, because as far as I was concerned, my father was just gone on another case. So the first time I actually sat down with the feeling of knowing was having to go through it, having to see the pictures, having to relive that moment was at that time.
This next part is really hard to listen to. It is the testimony of Armand Nofumela to the TRC, in which he recounts the way in which Griffith Mnenge was murdered.
He then drove ahead of us and we followed him. When we got to his house, we actually used another route and we got there first before him. We then parked our car not far from his house. We then waited for him there.
Nofumela said he and his companions pretended that they had broken down at the side of the road as a way of trapping Mnenge.
He then asked us if he could help us. We said yes. We asked him to shift over. He switched his car off. Joe then entered into the car. I got to the car at the back.
When they reached the Mlazi Stadium, where they believed they would not be discovered, David Tsikilanga stabbed Griffith Mnenge.
David Chikalanga. He's the first one who stabbed him. And then from there, with the exception of Brian, Brian just stood there with his gun.
So that's
when we started stabbing him. Until he died.
Now, how many times was Mr. Mnenge stabbed?
I cannot remember, sir.
More than 10 times? Less than 20 times?
It's possible, sir.
More than 30 times?
They too, sir, I cannot dispute it.
Tell us what happened finally before you could leave the scene to Mr. Mnenge.
I remember him lying there when we were going to leave.
Was his throat not being cut with a knife?
I did not look at that. I cannot give evidence.
Was his stomach not torn open with a knife?
Sir, I did not take note.
Griffith Mnenge was stabbed 43 times, but the evidence of his killers revealed just how hard he had fought to live. At one stage, even pulling out the knife used to stab him in the chest and chasing one of his killers with it in his hand. Once he had fallen, his murderers unleashed excessive and horrific violence upon his body.
You were talking about how your grief kicked in during the TRC and looking at photos and things like that. I mean, why do you ever regret like looking at those photos? Do you ever think, I wish I had not seen that? Or was it important for you to see what had actually happened to him?
So my father was big, literally, like he was tall. He was a big guy. He had a big voice and he would scoop us up. So that's the man that I remembered. So seeing the pictures was hard for me because I couldn't reconcile in my brain on the father that I know and this man. So it was, yeah, it was a difficult time, so to speak, to see the level of cruelty that he died. Because they didn't have to But it's something I guess I needed to see. I don't regret.
Mm.
It's something I needed to see for myself, I think, particularly because I think it's important for me. It was important for me to know that even in his last breath, he fought for his life. So it was not just about fighting figuratively and the injustices of South Africa, but he was willing to fight for it literally. So knowing that he's even in his stillness, I guess he's the brave man that I thought he was, because he was my father. So seeing the pictures is very hard.
It is at this point in the interview with Mabasa and Namhla Mncenge that Mabasa asked that we stop. His brother Vuyiwe had not attended this interview because of the huge levels of trauma still attached to his parents' death. And that is completely understandable, as is the visible and heartbreaking pain of Mabasa and his sister.
I suppose I still try to block that even today. And I suppose one of the difficulties is that I've even found it difficult to tell my own children the story.
The Mncenge family strongly opposed amnesty being granted to Nofumela, Chikilanga and Kutsia. But the ANC, the party that Griffiths and Victoria Mncenge had served at such profound cost to themselves, did not. The party said that as a pioneer of the truth and reconciliation process, it would abide by the Amnesty Committee's decision. Quote, "It is our belief that the TRC is equal to the task of taking independent decisions that are in the best interest of the country and in the context of promoting unity, reconciliation and peace among our peoples," ANC spokesperson Ronnie Manwepa said at the time. The ANC arguably had its own reasons not to oppose Kutsia's amnesty application. Within days of Nofumela's 1989 death row confession, Kutsia had sought an audience with Jacob Zuma and other leaders, and after revealing the full nature of his death squad activities, defected to the ANC.
After I left the environment that I worked in, the security environment, after I left the country and I met up with these people that was portrayed to me as monsters of the ANC, Jacob Zuma, JJ Njeli, and these people, after I saw the human kindness, the warmness, the heartiness, the just normal human beings, I couldn't believe done this against these people, that this was my attitude towards these people.
After returning to South Africa in 1993, Kutsia was later appointed to a senior position in the National Intelligence Agency. He told the TRC that he had met with one of Griffiths Mncenge's brothers in early 1994.
What else can I offer them? A pathetic nothing. So, in all honesty, I don't expect the Mncenge family to forgive me, because I don't know how I ever in my life would be able to forgive a man like Dirk Kutsia if he's done to me what I've done to them. But I will hope that this will be the beginning of a new era in my life, that I can just turn my back on it and walk on.
Kutsia may have been able to move on, but it's clear that the Mncenge family is still struggling to do so. We asked Matthews Pauser, who was one of the ANC leaders who had met with Kutsia, if he ever questioned how easily the death squad commander had been allowed to walk away from the horror that he had orchestrated against Griffiths Mncenge and other anti-apartheid activists.
Is there any part of you that thinks that people like Dirk Kutsia...
I can tell you, everything about me says he should have been hanged, but it's not the policy of my organization. That's my instinct feeling. And we can't run countries on the basis of instincts and anger. I'm outraged by people like him. There's no one moment of praising them at all for the murder and the filth they did in this country. But that's an emotional statement. At the end of the day, we have to build a nation and reconcile our people and move on. Nations must move on. A nation that does not move on and lives in the past. It dies already where it's standing.
But sometimes I worry that maybe we made that deal too easily.
I don't think so. I think it's an armchair critic who was not in the heat of the war who made that statement.
Dirk Kutsia died in 2013 at the age of 78. Armand Nofomela was released on parole for the murder of Johannes Lawrence in 2009 after serving 22 years of his life sentence. When we contacted him to request an interview, he asked for money. We refused.
I don't like South African journalists.
Okay. Why is that?
I'll tell you, when I made my confession, they twisted everything in their written, and made as if I'm the one who's been killing people.
I knew who killed them. Not that I killed them. I knew.
But you do admit you were part of a group that killed Griffith, but you're just saying I didn't kill everyone else.
Yes, I made it clear, but the journalist said they didn't say that, they said the opposite. However, that is not the case. I'm prepared to help you wherever you want to help, but we have to make a consultation.
When we tried to contact Nofomela again, his phone number no longer existed. He remains one of the characters in this tragic story that is the hardest to understand. A black man who willingly participated in the murder of another black man who was fighting the racist tyranny that imprisoned both of them.
Were you under the impression or were you told that you were fighting on behalf of the government?
So it was quite obvious that I am fighting for the government, because most of the things I was doing to people like myself, full of blacks and not whites, and the whites were in government then.
In many respects, Griffith Mnenge was killed by men who were the exact opposite of him. People who contended that they had no choice but to follow orders, without for one moment questioning whether those orders were morally defensible. For the Mnenge children, whose parents' murderers walked free, that must be very difficult to understand. Even more so, because those in power who ordered the killings of Griffiths and Victoria Mnenge have never been held accountable.
To a large extent, I think they were much bigger than father and mother. They attached themselves to every struggle that sought to bring back people's dignity. They were proud of the fact that they took a view that they would live by their convictions, that regardless of what happens, their convictions come first. And they are not going to be swayed by fear of death. I think we've ran our lives, particularly through of us, in a way where we would not want to disappoint them, even though they're not here. We would want to do everything in our power that, we don't, no one can point a finger and say, but you are not your father's child, or you are not your mother's child, or your mother's child.
Spirit of truth, set us free.
Unresolved was brought to you by SMWX. Visit the WhatsApp channel on smwx.co.za.